Illinois has been losing residents for some time, but according to BGA editor Bob Sector, yelling "the population is falling" does no one any good.
We're not going to even start to deal with a solution to this until people stop trying to point fingers and lay blame for something and actually try to take a sophisticated look at a difficult and complicated problem.
Plus, Southern Illinois University has become bitterly divided, so much so that its board of trustees voted 4-4 against suspending the university's president. Here's SIU trustee Joel Samburski.
President Dunn's job is to advance the SIU system. It's to advocate for the SIU system, not maneuver behind the scenes to stall, divide, and ultimately try to work to dissolve it.
And soon, if you call 911 from an iPhone in Chicago, it will automatically share your location data with first responders. What about the rest of Illinois? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone enjoyed their weekends. It's ready for this Monday. Coming up this hour, we're going to be delving into the situation at Southern Illinois University, where even the Board of Trustees is divided about what direction to take the school, and get an update, as we like to do on Mondays, of state politics. But first, you've likely seen the headlines about how much Illinois has been slowly losing residents. In 2016, Illinois lost more than 37,000 residents. That's more than any other state. And there's some popular explanations out there for this. Everything from taxes that are too high, regulations too unfriendly for business, and a pension system that's overrun with debt. Here's just a sample of some things you might have heard about why Illinois is losing population in the past couple of years.
Last year, we lost more people than any other state in America.
Property taxes are a huge issue. Government cannot afford to continue along the same path because the residents are leaving.
Jobs are leaving Illinois, and guess what? People are following them.
That was Governor Rauner, State Representative Jeannie Ives, and former State Senator Christine Redonio. Thanks to producer Robin Lynn for putting that together for us. And then there was Chris Kennedy, who perhaps had the most dramatic response to us when we asked him a couple of months ago why he wanted to become governor.
I don't want to die alone, and I'm worried because the next generation of kids in Illinois are leaving the state.
Today, we wanted to talk about, when it comes to people leaving Illinois, if the numbers match all of this hype, or have we become a little bit too much the sky is falling when we say the population is falling? The Better Government Association recently reported on this, and joining me now is senior editor Bob Sector. Rob Peral is also on the line with us. He's a demographer and fellow in the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Morning.
Morning, Bob. Let me start with you. Let's start with the reasons why people are leaving and why we hear about this. And I think the most popular thing that we hear is, as you heard, particularly what our politicians say, and that's taxes. Is that true?
Well, part of what we've been trying to point out here is we don't really know. These are complicated issues. And the numbers that we've looked at, point to a problem, but it's not clear why the problem exists, and it's not even clear it's as extreme as it exists. What it has become, unfortunately, is a talking point for politicians and ideological partisans to exploit, but they're cherry picking their data, and they are making it sound like the sky is falling, and that kind of obscures or takes away the room to actually take a broader look and a more closely better thought out analysis of why this problem exists.
If you have questions or comments about this issue, as we're talking about the misconceptions about why people leave Illinois, how many people are actually leaving, you're always welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet your comments to 21STShow. Bob, so the taxes are kind of a shorthand. There has been maybe people leaving Illinois has become a political shorthand by politicians. What are some other popular misconceptions you think there are around this conversation?
Well, I mean, this you hear from our governor all the time that, you know, Indiana is kicking our tails and we ought to be kicking their tails and everything's better elsewhere. And one thing that I like to contrast Scott Walker in Wisconsin with Bruce Rauner in Illinois. The governor of Wisconsin, whether he's right or wrong, is always talking up Wisconsin. And that creates an impression, probably overblown, that things are wonderful there. We have a governor here who is always bad-mouthing his own state, and that creates a different impression.
You know, it's certainly something lots of people have remarked upon. We're speaking with Bob Sector, BGA's senior editor. Rob Perel is also with us. He's a demographer with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Rob, there are probably people who are listening thinking, oh, I mentioned that number, 37,000 people in 2016. Does that really matter?
I don't think it matters in the big picture. You know, we would like to live in an area that's booming with growth. There's something about growth that a lot of us really on a psychological level take as personally affirming. Like, yeah, I live in a place that's, you know, really attracting people from all over the world or the country. But no, 37,000.
It's kind of like we're winning, right, Rob? It's sort of like, oh, we're a success. Everyone wants to be a part of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a powerful psychological feeling that we have. And then when someone takes a little bit of a decline, and turns it into that negative message, like there must be something wrong with you since you're losing population. You know, that's partly what's going on here, is this kind of war of psychologies.
Okay, before we get into more of what the something wrong is, Rob, I wonder if you can give us a little context on these numbers when we're looking at
sure.
how much of the population loss, how long has this been happening, how similar are we to other states, our neighbors in the Midwest? Can you place this in context for us, please?
Yeah, thanks for asking about the big picture, because the big picture really matters. So let's start with the fact that Illinois has been losing population since the Second World War, and Chicago's population peak was 1950. And you have a similar story of Midwestern states and Midwestern cities. So we're part of what's going on, although there are other things, is that there's a national, you know, very macro-level movement of population from the north and Midwest to the south and west. And you can't discount that. So that sort of, in a way, blows away some of these minor issues of what today's tax rate is or not. So that's one major thing going on. If you don't mind, a couple other things I think are really important to point out to understand the big picture in Illinois and the Midwest is let's take the state of Wisconsin as an example. It has a labor force, you know, people who are in the labor force and working, that is actually in numeric decline right now. And that's true of some other states. It's not true of Illinois. But the entire Midwest and Northeastern states are facing this declining demographics because our population, which is majority white, is really aging. It's aging, and too many of the young people, as I say, move to the South and West. These are really big factors going on.
And people are having less children, right? Particularly when we look at the white population?
On top of it, it's a bit of a perfect storm, you know? You have the aging demographics. You have these multi-decade trends. And then something that's really critical for Illinois is that we have always been a beacon for immigration. And immigration of different kinds has just been either getting cut by the government or is being blocked at the border or is slowing down for its own reasons.
And Rob, when we look at immigrants, if I remember the numbers correctly, immigrants, particularly the Latino population, have been what has accounted for the population growth in Illinois when we look at the birth rate. Is that correct?
Absolutely. If you back in the year 2000, the census found that the city of Chicago had grown for the first decade since the decade of the 1940s, and everybody was, you know, happy. A lot of politicians said, you know, this or that. It was all the growth was due to immigration. So immigration allowed us to make up for changes in other groups like white people leaving, et cetera. And boy, you pull out the plug of immigration, you pull that plug on Illinois, on Chicago, on other Midwestern states, and you really see the results in declining population.
That's Rob Perel. He's a demographer with the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Bob Sector's with us from the BGA, where he's a senior editor. Bob, I think the other question about this is just also as we're looking at just trying to understand the context of this. And when we have this conversation in sound bites, that makes it a little bit difficult to get at the reality as well, is that this looks very different depending on what part of Illinois you look at, right?
Yeah, I think that, and Rob might back me up on this, is that Illinois outside of the Chicago metro area, the experience is pretty much the same as the experience throughout almost all of the Midwest. They're losing population. It's dribbling away, and it's also getting older. Chicago, because Chicago is sort of the magnet of the Midwest, is a different story. But and there is something I would like to ask Rob about that I don't fully understand yet. But the census has something called hard to count census tracts, and it looks like that, you know, when you get into an urban area like Chicago, there's a concentration of hard to count numbers, and that's why. These estimates, which are gyrate wildly from year to year for the Chicago area, and generally get recalculated upwards after the scary headlines have been generated by the numbers that are released. And I'm just wondering if that's our problem here, is that we live in an area with a lot of minority population where it's harder to reach people and get them to respond to the census.
Rob, is that true?
It's certainly true that folks who have lower incomes, folks who don't own their home, folks of relatively lower education, who have people in their households who don't speak English well, who are foreign-born, you know, all of those things combine to lower the average response rate, as they call it, to the census. And guess who has a lot of those folks? It's urban areas. It's places like Chicago. So that's definitely an issue. And actually, maybe we're planning on getting to this eventually, but that raises the question of what the current administration in Washington.
I was just going to ask you that, Rob, because as we're hearing so much conversation about particularly immigration questions and the census, as a demographer, as it stands right now, are you concerned about getting an accurate count of what the population is in Illinois?
So we're a heavily diverse area, a lot of immigrants in our area. Already it's a hard-to-count population. And if you wanted to, in the abstract, come up with just the best thing you could possibly do to lower the count in Chicago, if you could just really target the city of Chicago and cause it to lose population in terms of who's counted, you would do what the administration is thinking of doing, which is adding these questions about citizenship. It's kind of deadly for cities of immigrants.
Apart from these numbers and what these numbers look like, I just wanted to spend our last few minutes looking at what we know about why this is happening. And Rob or Bob, I'm not sure which one of you wants to jump in here, but when you said earlier that young people, and when we look at nationwide trends, more young people, particularly more people, are moving to the South and to the West. Rob, why is that?
There's two things that are important. One is, some of it is what we call an attitudinal change and a lifestyle change. The South and the West became livable with the invention of air conditioning after the Second World War. And we all know folks who just simply want to be near mountains and seashore, et cetera. And you can do that now in a way that you couldn't do that in the past. So there have been these social, you know, what do we celebrate in Hollywood and movies and television shows?
Sunshine.
We celebrate people being
in warm weather, right? Sunshine. Yeah.
So no doubt about it. And there's one other thing. I don't want to turn off track too much, but there's something else I want to make sure we address in our conversation today, which is that there's one group that explains everything. Everything we've been saying about population loss would just be not an issue. We wouldn't even be talking here except for one single population, which is that the city of Chicago and Cook County and Illinois are having a reverse great migration of African Americans. It's African-American population loss explains all of the flat and slow growth, much more than any other group, even with the declining immigrants, et cetera. And that's a topic that needs to be looked at, is what is causing African Americans to leave the state in the numbers they are, much more than any other population.
And a reverse Great Migration, in other words, going back to the South, which is what we saw before World War II, from the turn of the previous century up until the 30s and 40s, a tremendous influx from the South to the Midwest, which you're now saying is reversed. Bob, as we're wrapping up here, I just want to ask you how you think, as you've talked a lot about the headlines and the misconceptions, how should we be thinking about this issue, knowing that it's a complex one?
Well, the one thing you should do, and I think Rob touched on this, you shouldn't get hung up on these year-by-year estimates, which gyrate wildly and are subject to significant revisions, because that creates a misleading impression. You also need to dispense with, or you need to consider the source when you hear people exploiting this, be that politicians or some advocacy groups that are trying to exploit it. And then the bigger picture is you would want to convene a lot of stakeholders here, from the right to the left, the business community, labor, to actually talk about these things and try to come up with some concrete understanding of what's happening, why it's happening, and how we can deal with it, given the resources we have and the needs we have. And if you do that, you know, you're not going to solve the problem necessarily, but you're going to understand it better, and you're going to mitigate some of the harm that's being done by people who are trying to exploit issues they don't fully understand.
Certainly a good thing to remember as the rhetoric will continue to heat up during this campaign season. I want to thank Bob Sector with the Better Government Association, a senior editor, and Rob Perrell, a demographer who's also a fellow in the Global Cities Program of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every year, 70% of 911 calls across the country are made from cell phones. That number is even higher in the city of Chicago and other urban areas. And starting this fall, if you call 911 from an iPhone in Chicago, that will automatically share your location with first responders. Chicago is just the latest of a host of other cities across the country who have been implementing similar technology over the past couple of years. Joining me now to talk about this is Ellie Mirati, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Ellie. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how does this technology work, Ellie? I think people might be surprised that this doesn't exist already. In fact, I think I called 911 once and they asked me where I was, and I was like, can't you tell? Because I'm calling from my cell phone. How does this work?
Yeah. It's kind of shocking. You would think that they would be able to find us by now. So basically, users need to download iOS 12, which Apple is set to release this fall. And then it'll happen automatically. So for users, like I said, they don't have to do anything. But the 911 center's technology currently relies on landlines. Like, they can't use your cell phone really to connect you the way, like, to find you the way that Uber would or something like that. I don't know exactly, you know, all the technicalities behind it, but they're using cell phone towers and that sort of thing to find you. So it's not very exact. So basically what will happen with this new technology is that there's a startup based in New York that's working with Apple to do this. And they will gather your information from your phone, your location, and then they'll send that over to the 911 call centers. So it's secure. You know, they say that only the 911 call center that gets your call will be getting your data. I know there's a big kind of data privacy concern right now out there. It's really seamless for the user, for the 911 call center. All they have to do is upgrade the technology they're already using, because this New York startup is working with the companies that provide software to the 911 call centers. So it'll just kind of like roll out with their upgrade.
Now this will not, so this is for iPhone users, but it's only for people who are using, is it iOS 12?
Right, yeah, and that's supposed to roll out this fall.
So if you have the latest iPhone technology and you do the software updates, you shouldn't have to do anything else on your phone for this to work.
Right, you just call 911 and they'll be able to find you. And again, like you said, when you call 911, you know, protocol at a lot of these places, the first thing they ask you is, what's your location? I talked to someone out in DuPage County, which is a suburb of Chicago, and he said that that protocol is not going to change. They're still going to ask the caller where they are. But where this is going to come in handy is for people who don't know where they are, right? Like maybe they just crossed the city line or a county line and they don't exactly know where they're at. This will help expedite the 911 call center being able to locate that caller.
That's actually what happened to me. Now that you say that, Ellie, I was on the phone. I was on the road and I was driving and there was a really bad accident that happened right in front of me. And I wanted to let them know right away. And they said, where are you? And I was like, I'm driving. I'm on the road. I don't know exactly
right.
where I am. Now, how will this work? And I'm curious, are there plans to implement this outside of Chicago? Is this something that it has to be done via each 911 dispatch office?
Yeah. So when I spoke with the technology company that's working on this is called Rapid SOS. And I spoke with their vice president of public safety. And he said that they're like, you know, obviously the dream would be to get this into as many 911 call centers as possible, which is why they're making it easy to roll out, you know, and working with their software companies that they already use instead of having to go in and train everyone. So I don't know that they have a timeline to roll this out to the entire country or anything like that, but that would be the goal, right? And Apple latching onto this and, you know, helping to make this easier for 911 call centers is obviously a huge step because, like you were saying earlier, 75% of calls made in Chicago to 911 are done on a cell phone. And it's about the same, you know, nationwide. So getting Apple out there with iPhone users to do this is a huge step.
Are there any security concerns with this? You mentioned that that's one of the reasons why this has taken so long to get set up.
I don't think there is at this point. Apple says that the data will be secure. I know right now there's a lot of talk of, you know, users having to opt in to share their data and that sort of thing. I read a couple other stories that different news organizations around the country wrote about this, and I saw a really good point that was made from a former FCC leader on this. He said, you know, when you're calling 911, you're basically opting in, right? Like, you know that they're...
Well, you're asking for help, right?
Right, you're asking for help, and, you know, you need to tell them where you are. So, I mean, I don't know. What Apple says that basically, you know, the data is secure, so it's not like by giving your location, the 911 call center is going to go use that for other purposes. It's to find you and make sure that you're safe.
That will be starting this fall in Chicago. We'll look out to see when this will happen for the rest of the state. Calling 911 from an iPhone, as we're saying, you have to have iOS 12 or higher, so the latest update when it happens. So also, I guess this also includes the newest iPhones as well, Allie. But Allie's been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune. We will tweet out her story if you want to read more about this. Allie, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For more than 60 years, Southern Illinois University has had two campuses, Carbondale and Edwardsville. Much like the U of I system, these campuses have their own faculty and students, but are led by one president. That president, Randy Dunn, was nearly suspended last week for 4 months by his own board of trustees. 4 out of the 8 members voted to put President Dunn on administrative leave for 120 days. They say he's been trying to undermine the system by favoring Edwardsville over Carbondale. The other 4 voted against them. For more on this, we're joined now by Jennifer Fuller, Associate Director for News and Public Affairs at WSIU Public Broadcasting in Carbondale. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, before we get to this 4-4 vote, I wanted to just ask you about the relationship between these two campuses in general. They're about 2 hours away from each other. Can you tell us a little bit about, I think everyone knows SIU Carbondale being the original campus. Can you tell us a little bit of the history of Edwardsville, when it was created, and what the relationship is like right now?
Well, sure. As you said, it was several decades ago when Delight Morris was president that SIU Edwardsville was kind of put into place as a satellite campus to SIU Carbondale. And since that time, it's grown into its own campus. It is its own school, not just a satellite of the Carbondale campus. There are still a lot of remnants of that, though. You hear people talk about Carbondale as the mother campus or the flagship campus. But as time has gone on, as things have progressed, you see Southern Illinois University Edwardsville growing in population, growing in enrollment, and as you reported and we've spent time taking a look at over the last several years, SIU Carbondale has had an enrollment decline for nearly all of the last 20 years.
And what does it look like in Edwardsville?
In Edwardsville, the enrollment is growing, and there are a lot of reasons for that, most notably a large metropolitan area in St. Louis that it can draw from. The leaders there also point to the fact that they're the lowest cost public institution in the state, a four-year university. SIU Carbondale has had some administrative turnover that they blame for their enrollment decline. What it leads to, though, is as we sit here in July of 2018, almost July, it's still June as a matter of fact, that the enrollment at SIU Edwardsville this fall could eclipse SIU Carbondale.
And what are SIU Carbondale's enrollment numbers looking like, Jennifer?
SIU Carbondale was roughly, I believe, 13 or 14,000 students. Forgive me for not having the exact total right in front of me.
That's helpful, though, I think, for folks to have an understanding of at least the ballpark size of the campus. And it's kind of it's amazing to think, Jennifer, that that's double that is what's happening in Edwardsville. If we're putting both of the campuses together, that's a pretty significant school population.
Southern Illinois University is one of two systems in the state. As you mentioned, the University of Illinois earlier as you opened up this part of the program, the University of Illinois is the larger system in the state. Southern Illinois University has the two campuses in Carbondale and Edwardsville. It's also got a very large presence in Springfield because that's where the School of Medicine is. But there are also schools in Alton, in East St. Louis. There are lots of places affiliated with Southern Illinois University's School of Medicine, its School of Dental Medicine, so it's got quite a large reach.
And are all the medical services, that's in the Springfield area, correct?
Well, the medical students for Southern Illinois University will start their first year on the Carbondale campus, and then they move to Springfield for their remaining years. But outside of that, SIU, its School of Medicine outreach, there's a large family practice center in Quincy. There's one in Springfield. There's one in Decatur and other parts downstate. The mission of the School of Medicine is for rural and underserved areas in Illinois.
Jennifer, let's get to now this vote that happened, and this has been brewing for some time, this issue of President Dunn and whether or not people have confidence in his leadership. What led to this point?
Well, you almost have to go back about a year to really get into where this debate started. And that was when the state was still inside its budget stalemate. There were questions about whether or not some universities would even be able to keep their doors open. And SIU Carbondale was struggling. It came to a board vote last summer to do an inter-system loan that the school in Edwardsville, SIU Edwardsville, would loan SIU Carbondale, I believe it was roughly $30 million, just to allow them to make it through the stalemate. That was a very contentious issue. The staff and faculty at SIU Edwardsville were, in many cases, adamantly opposed to that because they had made cuts of their own. They believed that SIU Carbondale needed to make cuts of its own in order to make ends meet. In the end, that loan was approved. When the stalemate was over, the loan was paid back. So I suppose you could say for bookkeeping purposes, things were back even. But at that time, that's when you started hearing people at SIU Edwardsville talk about a reallocation study, taking a closer look at how state funds were distributed between SIU Carbondale and SIU Edwardsville. And for the most part, that discussion was kind of behind the scenes. You would hear about it, but there wasn't a large discussion. That changed in March when the SIU Board of Trustees was on retreat, and they heard from SIU Edwardsville asking for a funding reallocation, additional monies going to Edwardsville because of their enrollment growth and SIU Carbondale's enrollment decline. And there was a consensus at that meeting among the board members that there should be a study, that things should be looked at, and it ought to be an outside organization looking at it. Some people at SIU Carbondale were then surprised at the next trustees meeting in April that there was a question, an item on the agenda that would have transferred $5 million, it was $5.125 million in state funding from Carbondale's appropriation to Edwardsville's starting in the fiscal year that starts July 1st. That ultimately failed. It was another tied vote. So that's when things really started to get really contentious.
Right.
And that's the point where
it gets up, and it does get right. That's sort of, it did get pretty, there's a lot, I think, more to this in terms of the contention, conversations about SIU President Randy Dunn. And just to get a little sense of that, Jennifer, I wanted to play some audio that you actually gathered. It's something from SIU trustee Joel Samburski. Here's what he said about Randy Dunn.
President Dunn's job is to advance the SIU system. It's to advocate for the SIU system, not maneuver behind the scenes to stall, divide, and ultimately try to work to dissolve it.
That's SIU trustee Joel Samburski. Jennifer, we're speaking with Jennifer Fuller with WSIU in Carbondale. What's behind why a trustee would say that the president is favoring one campus over the other?
Well, I want to start out by saying I haven't seen the FOIA'd documents that these trustees are pointing to that say that the president was undermining. But what they accuse President Dunn of doing was working with Edwardsville to craft that proposal that I talked about that came up at the April board meeting, that transfer of $5 million. They also say that in taking a neutral stance on legislation in Springfield that would split the two campuses or change the appropriation or reconstitute the board, there were three different bills, that was another way that the president was actually undermining Carbondale and trying to boost Edwardsville. Again, I haven't seen the documents that they point to. We do have a request in, and as soon as we get those, we'll certainly be taking a closer look.
Jennifer, we just have about 2 minutes left, but I just wanted to ask you about local residents in Carbondale and Edwardsville. How much are people talking about this?
Oh, it's certainly top of mind. There are people very concerned about what happens to each campus as this moves forward. If there is a split, what happens to Edwardsville? What happens to Carbondale? Because of the enrollment decline in Carbondale, there's a lot of talk about what happens to the economy in the far southern part of the state. SIU is the largest employer in the southern part of the state. If you head into the Metro East, it's one of the largest employers. So there's a lot of talk about what happens if the two are split, or if they stay together, which campus is the controlling campus, if there is one, or how they can work together in the future.
Is there an outcome here? This like seems like it's pretty messy, and I'm having a hard time seeing a resolution here that isn't also equally messy, Jennifer.
There is some cautious optimism. At last week's meeting, where most of the focus was on this vote that concerned President Dunn, there was also approval of a study. They're going to find an outside firm that will look at the allocation and how those monies are spent between Carbondale and Edwardsville. Now, that takes time, and so this next year, everyone's kind of trying to tread lightly, but they say they're looking forward to hearing what that consultant says in terms of how the money can be distributed, perhaps a more equitable way between the two campuses, and perhaps that's the way that the system can move forward.
And in the meantime, Randy Dunn stays in his job. He's the president, right?
At least for the time being, yes.
That's Jennifer Fuller. She's Associate Director for News and Public Affairs at WSIU in Carbondale, joining us to explain a little bit more about what would normally be a quiet summer down in Carbondale and Edwardsville has not been for SIU. Jennifer, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the 21st, we're going to be rounding up the latest political news with the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson and the Peoria Journal Star's Chris Kiergaard. Mostly, we're going to be talking about the new gubernatorial race, the new gubernatorial election coming up. Tuning in to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Governor Bruce Rauner is under fire from his political opponents for what he said about black lawmakers. Speaking of political opponents, he may soon have another one in the race for governor. And even though the legislative session has ended, lawmakers are holding hearings over the issues of Chicago public school students being sexually abused. It's all part of our regular conversation around state politics. And to break all of this down, we're joined now by the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson and the Peoria Journal Star's Chris Kiergaard. Rick, Chris, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Good
morning. Let's start with perhaps a new entrance into the governor's race today. Republican State Senator Sam McCann is expected to file paperwork today to launch. Rick, this is a third party bid for governor, correct?
Correct. It would be under the new conservative party, rather. And obviously, this is kind of an outgrowth of what we saw from the Republican primary when Republican State Representative Jeannie Ives of Wheaton came within 3 percentage points of upending Governor Rauner's reelection bid.
And I wonder, Chris, if you can share a little bit about the history between Senator McCann and Governor Rauner. Certainly, well, we've had Senator McCann on the program. I think he's made his feelings about Governor Rauner pretty clear. How long does that history between the two of them not really getting along go back?
That feud goes as long as the governor's term has gone. Senator McCann has voted against the governor on several issues related to the senator's district, which is a very union-heavy district, and the governor returned the favor not quite 2 years ago by supporting a challenger against the senator in his primary election, and the governor was unsuccessful at that, but really tried to take out McCann at that point. So there's absolutely no love lost between the two of them.
And when we think about no love lost between the two of them, I'm thinking about other members of the Republican Party. Rick, you mentioned Jeannie Ives, state representative. How big of a faction within the Republican Party would we see or would we suspect is going to be working against Governor Rauner in his reelection bid?
Well, the party still remains very divided coming out of the primary. And there's no doubt that the governor has been trying to unify the core conservative Republican base. The conservative base still angry over his support of legislation that expanded abortion rights, expanded transgender rights, expanded immigration rights. And with McCann, if he survives what's expected to be a challenge to his petitions when he files them, but with McCann, you kind of have this conservative, core conservative group. McCann avidly supporting Donald Trump, but you also have that union backing that Chris mentioned, which provides another element to it. It widens the scope, and there's no doubt that, you know, in a blue state with Rauner facing severe criticism, a huge challenge from Democrat J.B. Pritzker, the entrance of Sam McCann into the race, should he stay on the ballot, that takes points away from Rauner.
Rick, as we're talking about the governor's race, I just want to shift topics for a minute here and ask you about something else. And that's discuss something that your colleagues at the Chicago Tribune have their investigative reporting has uncovered. And that's the issue of sexual assault at Chicago public schools. Two young women testified in front of a lawmaker committee. Even though the legislative session is over, there was last week a joint committee on education that met and talked about how They were sexually abused by teachers. And I wanted to play some audio from you all that you collected from the hearing. Here's Morgan Aranda testifying before the committee, and she's talking about how the teacher who sexually abused her is still being paid by CPS.
Let me make that abundantly clear for all of you. CPS currently pays the teacher who sexually assaulted me, a man who, in his own words, felt more affection toward me than any other of his students, but claims innocence, a pension.
Rick, I think we have a little sense of some of the emotion behind what she's saying, which sounds like a really difficult situation. What was the mood like at the hearing?
Very, very much critical of Chicago Public Schools. Absolutely very critical of Chicago Public Schools. I mean, you know, bottom line is everybody thinks of a school as the safe place. And with my colleagues at the paper and their reporting and getting into the story of the number of faculty members, staff members, these are supposed to be trusted people. And one of the things that I've heard most from lawmakers is, while, yes, you know, we're looking at the Chicago public schools, there are real questions about, if this is happening at CPS, where else is it happening around the state in smaller districts where that don't get the kind of scrutiny that the Chicago public schools provide? And so already,
or the scrutiny of the Tribune, for that matter, as well.
Correct. Correct. And so already you have lawmakers have sponsored legislation to try to tighten down on background checks, those kinds of things, bipartisan legislation. But truly, the scope of this, I think, goes much further than Chicago.
Any other solutions on the table, Rick, as far as legislation is concerned, what lawmakers will, when they're back in session, plan to offer?
Well, I think in addition to the legislation, you also have the factor, too, that, you know, we talk about the governor's race. We also have a developing mayoral race going on. And so you already have Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who's under fire for issues involving police, law enforcement, crime in the city. You now throw that, the CPS issue, into him. Chicago's the only school district in the state that is doesn't have a school board. It's really controlled by the mayor of Chicago, and this falls squarely into his lap.
Going back to the governor's race, I wanted to just ask you, you mentioned the mayor's race, Rick. I wanted to ask you about another incident that happened with Governor Rauner. He made some comments last week that didn't go over well with a few folks. It started when he told a Chicago radio station that he had done more for Black residents of Illinois than any other governor. And then what did he say after he was criticized for those remarks, Rick?
Basically, he doubled down. He said that African-American legislators are failing their constituency and that they should embrace his policies. He views things, and it's kind of an interesting needle that he tries to thread, is that he talks about things, and rightfully so, that his administration has done to try to encourage more government set-asides for minority-owned businesses to take part in state contracting. He's also given money to charter schools as a private citizen. But at the same time, he faults things like the social service safety net and kind of goes into a stereotype, if you will, that the only concerns he views African-American lawmakers as being concerned with are things about social service spending.
And he did say, quote, "I'm not surprised they're sensitive because the Black legislators aren't really serving their community well." What was the response from Black lawmakers? I imagine including Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. She's a candidate with J.B. Pritzker against Governor Rauner, was not going to let this one go.
No, and frankly, I think this may develop as a side theme for the race for governor, is they point to the fact that under Rauner, the social service safety net basically did crumble because of the historic budget impasse. Rauner, in that radio interview, said he's done more for African Americans than anyone. Well, here we are. This is the land of Lincoln. It's a pretty profound statement. And truly, it's not unusual for the governor to kind of make these statements. Back as a candidate in 2014, he said, "I've been successful at everything I've ever done." Well, I guess we'll find out in November.
We're speaking to the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson. Chris Kiergaard is also with us. He's with the Peoria Journal-Star. Chris, just before we wrap up this talk, this particular topic, I wonder, I'm not sure that the relationship between Governor Rauner and particularly Black Democratic leaders from Chicago has ever been great.
No, there's always been some struggle with the Black Democratic leaders from Chicago, and some of that has been the governor's attitude that Rick alluded to on the belief that there may be this single issue, the claim that they are not representing their constituents well. You'll recall that the governor viewed as somebody who was representing his constituents well Ken Duncan, who was the one Democrat who, when he was in the state house, the governor managed to get to go along with him on some fairly significant votes, and
then lost his seat,
to Giuliano Stratton,
right. Yes.
And that was, you know, Duncan's votes were viewed as a significant betrayal and an attempt by the governor to buy off a member of the community to support him. And, you know, Duncan's votes were, as I say, viewed negatively for what they represented overall to the goals of the Black Caucus and others in the legislature. So there's certainly been struggle there, and not just among Chicago Democrats, but among downstate African American Democrats too. Whether you're talking about,
well, I'm thinking of Letitia Wallace, right from Rockford,
mm-hmm. Jahan Gordon Booth in Peoria. The governor has made some other outreach beyond the contracting and other steps like that. He has started an initiative to try to help train or otherwise help Black entrepreneurs and businesses to expand that we've yet to see the result of. That was started about 16 months ago with a cadre of Black businesses from Peoria, Rockford, and Chicago, and we've yet to see whether or not that's going to lead to any success or not. There were a lot of people at the time who felt that it was just paying lip service rather than having any concrete action that came out of it.
We'll see what happens with that. Let's put politics for the side for a minute and end, Chris, by let me ask you, we don't normally talk about the Supreme Court when it comes to state politics, but this week the high court term ends and they've already handed down one decision that could affect state and local revenue everywhere, including Illinois. States now have more power to collect sales tax on internet sales. I know we've talked to particularly even Peoria city officials about how important this issue is, Chris. How much of a difference does the Supreme Court decision make in Illinois?
It's quite substantial to attune. The Illinois Municipal League estimates at about $207 million more in tax revenue coming into the state. If you talk to city officials in Peoria or other comparable communities, they'll tell you that when people choose to buy something online, the community's share of the sales tax that they receive from that is about a penny for every $100 you spend on Amazon or some other large website, compared to $2.75 for every $100 that you spend in a brick and mortar store in Peoria. So there's a significant losing out there that's resulted in major budget difficulties in communities, both cities as well as counties, with what they've had to cut back on. With that $207 million in change, which Illinois lawmakers did include a provision in this year's budget that allows that money to begin to be recaptured immediately. That, of course, all will be parceled out to cities and counties all around the state. So Peoria's estimated, quote unquote, win out of that is $1 million or thereabouts. But in a city that could be looking at a multi-million dollar budget shortfall again, the $1 million is something they're certainly viewing in a plus column.
Just a minute left. Rick, can I just ask you very quickly, the other major Supreme Court case decision we're waiting on is Janus versus AFSCME, a case that started with Governor Rauner. How important is this case for Governor Rauner, Rick Pearson?
I think it's very big. I mean, if, as expected, the court rules that public employees do not have to pay fair share fees, as it's known to public employee unions, It's basically Bruce Rauner's legacy. He has demonstrably sought to weaken the power of public employee unions. This would not just have ramifications for Illinois and unions that are traditionally allied with Democrats, but this has ramifications all across the country. And in fact, he's out in D.C. Waiting for this decision to be handed down.
Oh, it's such a big one. That is Rick Pearson with the Chicago Tribune. I want to thank Chris Kiergaard with the Peoria Journal Star. Gentlemen, thanks for talking state politics with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow, we've already checked in with Illinois farmers on President Trump's trade policy, but one of the many things that our farmers are doing with their corn is they're growing it here for ethanol. So tomorrow, we're going to be asking, what did farmers think about the Trump administration EPA when it comes to ethanol? Plus, how safe is the water at our park drinking fountains? WBEZ's Monica Ng joins us. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Pinlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information about us. We're a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.